Welcome to the Insightful Nurse Leader. This is a podcast by nurse leaders for nurse leaders. This show is focused on assisting leaders become effective managers and change facilitators. I'm your host, Miles Perilla. Join me every week as I speak with fellow nurse leaders, share insights, lessons learned, and practical advice. So, whether you're a seasoned frontline leader, a budding charge nurse, an experienced manager, or executive, you don't want to miss this. Hello and welcome everyone to the 12th episode of the Insightful Nurse Leader. Our guest today is a change management expert with extensive experience in operations and change management, specializing in implementation of healthcare, technology, and for other complex environment. Molly Angel, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Miles. Delighted to be here.
Well, Molly, what makes a successful organizational transformation, especially during this time in healthcare?
I know since the beginning of my career, we've always described healthcare as in a constant state of change, but I don't think any of us had envisioned the kind of Nantucket sleigh ride that we've had for the last couple of years. It sort of laid bare some of our very worst faults and cracks in the system, and really also, amazingly provided the environment where so many people really stepped up and, you know, did what needed to be done and, you know, very courageously as a front line of this pandemic, just, you know, really exhibited the very best of healthcare, which is that selflessness and that service to others. I think that the key word that I've really been focused on as we've kind of navigated this troubled time and think about how we're trying to even still negotiate and understand and make plans going forward is really compassion. The environment is just, you know, people are still so raw. The energy is still so, uneven in terms of how much, the current situation is still challenging to folks. And so really thinking of how to approach organizational transformation from the lens of compassion, I think is really our need at this point.
That's very insightful. Thank you. So in your practice, how do you differentiate your tailored approach compared to other areas of organization that focus on change leadership as well?
You know, I really do think of myself as sort of, that guide type character or somebody who really is helpful to leaders in particular to develop better skills and better approach to being facilitators of change and leaders of change and connecting the commitment level that's really required of folks who are being asked to make change to those leaders so that there really is a, I leave it behind me. I mean, if change is dependent on me being part of the equation, then I'm not a very good change manager. So I always think about how to create the opportunity for the folks within the team, within the environment, to be even more skilled and more comfortable with leading change so that as I'm, leaving the scene or as I extricate from the project or the program, it should be a very seamless, I say every once in a while, if people, need me to be there, then it's not a very successful change strategy. So I think a lot about the need to make sure that even during a project, you're thinking about the long-term consequences of what's changing and ensuring that the environment's very well prepared to continue the change, to become a more change agile organization even after I depart the project.
Yeah, for sustainability, succession planning in that regard. So the elephant in the room right now in healthcare, hospital finances. How do you justify the cost associated with any change effort, given our current climate with hospital finances?
Yeah, it's a very real problem. And, it's exacerbating some of the raw feelings and some of the just nature of unease that people are feeling because there is such a financially challenging environment. One thing I'm learning with the organizations that I'm working with currently, though, is that the folks who are very determined to ensure continued quality, to ensure continued innovation, to keep seeking those better ways of providing care, to keep exploring how to provide their teams with the resources and the skills they need to become even more adept at, you know, the transformation that our healthcare system so clearly requires, have really seen this as, you know, both threat and the opportunity. And they're making sure that even in belt tightening, even in the circumstances where, you know, there's not as much in the kitty as there used to be, that they're putting as much as they can in the dollars that are at the front of the line where the patient care takes place so that they can continue to serve their communities.
Especially now, a huge part of that is trying to control the cost of labor or premium expense in labor. You know, and with that, different organizations are in different stages of their flexibility or agility or what they can accommodate. Do you have any recommendation as far as what is the best way to present a case or to justify a proposal in that regard when there are multiple competing priorities, with our listeners regarding managing change?
Sure. Well, workforce planning is on the top of everybody's list right this minute, of course, Miles. The need for excellent care is not going to change. And what I think very forward and innovative thinking organizations are recognizing more than ever is that most of the solutions are in the minds and in the hearts of the folks who occupy the front of the equation, you know, those who deal with patients day in and day out, and especially those who are in a situation that, you know, have just learned all of these lessons through COVID about what does and what doesn't work. Tapping into that wisdom is, I think, going to be the successful strategy. And I've seen that now become clear with organizations as they're really trying to make sure that how they set themselves up and start to try to future-proof themselves, if that's at all possible in this environment, is really tapping into that frontline wisdom.
I agree. I totally agree. And really a big part of that is tapping into understanding the culture, underlying culture of a service line or an organization. With that thought, right, what about on situations where a culture in an organization have gone off rails, given that the past 2 years have not been easy? There's so many, you know, attrition or people transitioning to different roles, and there hasn't been consistency. And there are organizations that did not have a very inclusive or productive culture. As a change leader, how would you change your approach when a culture has gone off rails? How do you go about realignment to the ideal culture?
Inevitably, in a change management practice, as I said a little bit earlier, part of your process involves helping leaders become more change adept and recognizing their role and responsibility in not just leading, but in leading change, and identifying where the opportunities are to help somebody become better at that is always a big part of my process. A little bit of, you know, the idea of build a better sponsor. Everyone has what it takes within them to be a good change leader. It's just how well they really take up the attributes of, as we say in change management, expressing, modeling, and reinforcing change, which are, you know, the important elements of change leadership that I learned in my training, my accelerating implementation methodology, AIM-based change management training, that, you know, that's so important that leaders not just endorse a change or say, okay, I've approved the dollars for this change, but they really have to model the change. They have to express the change. They have to reinforce the change. And the way that they do this is by being an active sponsor, not by being passive. And that's really what makes a difference in terms of helping to realign a culture. Once a leader really starts to understand that their role is not a passive role, but an active role, and you use some of the elements of the AIM methodology, for example, to help leaders really become better sponsors, that's a huge impact on shifting a culture. Because as you know, people don't leave jobs, people leave managers. And so the better a manager can be at embracing change and being facile with change and becoming a more adept change leader, the better the environment is and the culture is for the folks that work with that leader.
You mentioned AIM as a method for change. Are there any traditional models of change, or are the traditional models of change still relevant, or in the past 2 years, have there been any new models of change that have proven to be or are proving to be more efficient and effective?
Well, one thing that I've noticed, and AIM is a terrific framework for change. I just, you know, I rely on it, and I find that it is just absolutely rock solid in terms of its the way that it's structured and the way that it helps you approach change from every angle, process, culture, methods, mechanisms. But there are a few things that I have seen in the last couple of years really grab hold and make a difference in terms of helping people who are really so overwhelmed and feeling so burned out. And that really comes from some of the training that I've had in another methodology called Liberating Structures. And it's specifically the element of liberating structures called positive deviance. So many times, especially in nursing, we're so focused on what went wrong and how to avoid what's going wrong and, you know, what the methods are, you know, to identify all of the potential for something going wrong and being so prescriptive about shoring up our practice and shoring up our approach. But in positive deviance, it sort of flips the script and it asks you to look at that which is going well. Because even in an environment where things are going wrong 9 times out of 10, there's that one time that it worked well. So what do we want to learn from the positive deviance? What do we want to understand about how things can go well, even in a situation that's very, very challenged? And I find that is amazingly freeing, especially in an environment where there, you know, there's sort of this traditional, you know, punishment. And, you know, we've seen that, you know, even in the press, that nurses are being punished for making mistakes. So it really changes the discussion. It really changes the conversation to start to talk about, well, what's going well and how is this going well? And doing a lot of, you know, among the peers, learning from each other, especially as someone has developed any kind of approach to their work that does seem like a more successful strategy. The credibility of their peers is, you know, is there if they are in the same environment. They have no more resources. They have no more advantages than anyone else, but they've figured out a way to do things somewhat more successfully. So positive deviance, I think, has become an important way that I help people look at their situation to find those nuggets of good practice and good process that you want everyone to learn from.
I like that. I like that. Positive deviance. It's really, instead of looking at the negative filter, right? Looking at, hey, how are we doing in light of our goals, our overall goals? So yeah, thank you for sharing that. So with all the changes, right, in healthcare, hospital specific, a lot of places have been in survival mode because short staffing, lack of funding, what have you. And unintentionally, a lot of managers have lowered their standards as far as accountability. Now that we're getting back to realignment, now that we're focused on changing to the better, when do we start working on accountability?
That's a great question. I think that there was the need to be very facile in how you were addressing keeping everything covered. I don't know that I saw any situations where I would say people actually lowered standards. I would say that people had to get pretty creative, and people had to look around and see, okay, what tools do we have in the toolbox that we haven't used for a while? You know, what do we have to, you know, brush off and think about using again? How do we, you know, rely more on our clinical pharmacists? And how do we, you know, the respiratory therapists, my gosh, I mean, you know, look at the role they had to jump in and to assume. I mean, there were, I think, some creative approaches to just keeping the, you know, keeping the situation together, and some, you know, real sheer grit and determination. That's, you can't survive, you can't continue to operate at that kind of high rate of, you know, revolution. That's just, that's a recipe for disaster. I mean, you have to do what you have to do when that situation exists, but you have to think about, how do we not get into that situation going forward? How do we make sure we have got the belt and suspenders and the, you know, and the plans in place? Now we know what the worst looks like. We just lived through it. We don't have to imagine or create scenarios anymore. And I think truly innovative leaders are looking at the opportunity, even in a very cost-constrained environment, to say, okay, what are the better ways to get things done? What is the more efficient, effective, and you know, we've got now data that tells us that, you know, we can eliminate some of these unnecessary steps, or we can create a different sort of teamwork environment where there's a little bit, you know, different sharing of the responsibilities. I think everyone's not only had to step up, but everybody's learned a little bit different strategy for working within a, you know, like a critical care environment, for example, that they might not ever have had the reason to surface and to discover, you know, what their true capabilities were. So I think that the accountability piece will really sort of follow how much, you know, they're able to reflect on what the changes were, reflect on what the information and the data is telling them about how they were able to accommodate this really, you know, extreme environment, and, you know, take some lessons learned from it. Some things they won't do again, and other things they'll say, okay, we had to do this while we had to do this, but how do we avoid having to do it in the future? More emergency preparedness. You know, we used to always just be like, oh, yeah, yeah, emergency preparedness. But boy, everybody's really paying attention to that now, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. Precisely. So talking about leadership, right, type of leadership, a lot of literature out there talks about transformational leadership being lauded to be one of the best type of leadership. And that involves empowering people, which makes a lot of sense. What are your thoughts on embodying transformational leadership while ensuring we still continue to deliver outcomes? Given in healthcare that we have a lot of KPIs to meet, deliverables to meet as well.
Yeah, I always think of healthcare as being one of those really the ultimate, you know, paradigm dichotomy kind of environments, because it's so highly regulated. You know, almost every organization that can has some sort of set of regulations or requirements around healthcare, be it from a payer's perspective or just a regulatory agency perspective. So it's a very highly regulated environment, not just around the data, which is what, you know, people generally understand, the, you know, the whole issue around the security and the, you know, the safety of the healthcare data. Every aspect of healthcare is so incredibly regulated. But it's also one of the more innovative industries in our country. I mean, when you think about how much all of the models of care have transformed over, you know, years to accommodate, you know, new discoveries and new techniques and new knowledge, you know, that's a constant sort of like push and pull between the regulatory environment and all this innovation. And I think there's very few people outside of the healthcare industry who really understand what true transformational leadership looks like on a day in, day out basis. Because of that You know, you need to be very, you know, firmly adherent to the regulations, but you're not going to succeed as an industry if you're not constantly innovating and constantly bringing in, you know, the newer, more effective, you know, more scientifically founded methods of care and outcomes that are in constant state of evolution. So I think, you know, a little bit back to what I said earlier, Miles, I think that the transformation really does require understanding what kind of commitment you need from people to make transformations. What does it look like for people to fully commit to and adopt the kind of transformation that you think is right for your organization, for your team? And really connecting the dots around how you obtain that commitment. And I still think a real key in this, you know, sort of rugged environment we are right now with such a terrible, you know, couple of years behind us, is really going to be, the key is going to be compassion as the lens to really understand the level of commitment that's required and do what it takes to not just be on time and on budget and satisfy all the technical requirements of change, but really keep the human factors of change on the same level as those technical and business requirements.
A very balanced approach. That's good. In leading a change effort, who are your real customers?
You know, in healthcare, our customers are always, you know, the people that we care for, in a sense. I know a lot of people don't like to call patients customers, but they really are the ultimate consumers of the good that's been, you know, developed, delivered, provided. So we do really need to think about how we are maintaining the very best relationship and you know, care for our communities. We're all members of the community where we provide care. You know, these are not strangers to us. These are our family members. These are our neighbors. These are the people we go to the swimming pool with. These are, you know, this is our community in you know, many, many cases. So, you know, doing the very best we can as an organization to really address the needs of our community, I think, is the ultimate outcome of, you know, the question of who our customer is. And of course, the providers within the environment are an important group of people to really make sure that you are, you know, establishing a good, healthy work environment and recognizing that you don't want people to be pushed to the limits of burnout like they have been. I mean, we're really, you know, we're experiencing such a terrible and very, you know, troubling outcome with, you know, the self-harm of some caregivers who just burned out during the situation. And we can't ever get there again, Miles. We absolutely have got to have lessons learned from all that and have a great deal more understanding of, you know, where the natural limits are for our you know, providers and our caregivers, so that we don't ever get to that point again.
So with every change effort, right, there's people who get on the bus and people who self-select to get off the bus. And we've seen that in not even outside a project itself. The past 2 years, a lot of caregivers have elected to switch to a different, or transition to a different role. With that, we all have this thought as leaders that retention is one of the top things that we monitor, retention rates. And understanding, like having compassion, right? Making sure that people are doing what they love to do, aligning to what resonates with them. What are your thoughts on using retention rates still as a measure of success?
I've sort of read the literature around sort of the, I don't know if you would call it controversy, but the, you know, the sort of, you know, are we thinking about this the right way? Is retention rate truly, you know, our best measure? I don't really have a solid feel for that right this minute. I know it's very much a traditional measure of satisfaction, is that, you know, as people are willing to stay in your environment, that clearly signals that you're doing something right. But there's all kinds of reasons why people, you know, don't want to stay in an environment. And some of them have to do with how well you're performing as an organization and providing a great place for them. And, you know, others are kind of outside our grasp. So it'll be interesting to see where that lands as the ultimate sort of measure of whether or not you're doing a good job. But I can definitely say, as I said a little bit earlier, you know, people don't tend to leave jobs because, you know, whoops, you know, I thought I'd like being a nurse and I don't like being a nurse. It's because they don't like their leadership, or they don't feel well supported by their leadership, or they don't feel that they have an opportunity to grow and to expand their practice and, you know, become better at what it is that they do love about their work, because they feel so, you know, restricted by poor management practices. So I think that, you know, whatever measures about how well people feel engaged where they are working and how they feel that they have, you know, a really solid team around them is probably something that would be a great way to get a better sense of whether or not you're doing the right things. In healthcare, so much of care is delivered in teams. And, you know, I think of like OR teams. Once you've got like a really solid team, boy, you're reluctant to leave that because, you know how hard it is to really come by that really, you know, great. You almost don't have to say much to people. They just understand how to work together. I mean, that's kind of a beautiful thing. And, you know, those things don't happen by accident. Those are very intentional environments that create that really great interactive and successful teamwork. And so measuring, you know, that is hard, but it's an important thing to understand about a healthcare environment.
Yeah, it definitely is complex. Thank you. So in my experience with changed leadership or working with different management consulting firms, one of the things that I still sometimes don't quite understand is when facilitators of, let's say, a change process or a process improvement project would say that's out of scope, or something is out of scope and we can't touch that, i.e. staffing or budgeting, what have you. From your thought, right, thinking about the bigger scheme of things in approaching a change, what is the best way to scope out a project before engaging in it?
That goes back to a little bit to my comments about commitment and what it takes to have people feel that they understand what's being asked of them, really gauging what your need for commitment is from certain groups. You know, some people, the change is going to be, you know, foundational to the way they do the work. So you have to have total commitment from those folks. So understanding what their issues are. And you mentioned a little bit earlier the idea that there's some people who get right on board with change and others who are reluctant. Actually, I love those reluctant people, and I like to talk to them right away because they're the ones that bring up all the resistance, the issues of resistance that you need to understand. Almost inevitably, they're the brave souls who are willing to say, you know what, here's why this is a problem and here's why I don't feel very engaged by this. The more you understand of that, the better job you can do. So I would say that, you know, you do have to scope projects. There's no such thing as a limitless scope to any particular project. But the human factors of change do have to address all the elements of what people require to be addressed in order to feel committed to the change that you're making so that they can adopt it. And if, you know, staffing requirements is something that's a huge red flag for them, you can't just say, well, it's out of scope. That is not a helpful answer, Miles.
Although I have encountered that before. Totally agree.
That happens a lot when people are just like, you know, on time and on budget. Man, on paper, this project looks like it was fully delivered. And I've been in projects like that where, you know, you walk away at the end and everybody's like, great, you know, the new process in place, all the new equipment's in place, the staffing has been shuffled around to line up with this new approach to the care. And the next thing you know, you got a bunch of nurses crying in the bathroom because, you know, they're not on board with this change. It's check, check, check boxes on time, on budget. But, you know, there's no commitment to what it is that's required to truly deliver on the change. And so, again, ignoring the human factors is a is a big mistake that people can make. And if people want to understand what the staffing requirements are, and that's a deal breaker, then it has to be part of the discussion, even if it's not an official part of the scope.
So thank you for this. This is really insightful. So Molly, you do have a podcast.
I do.
Right. Do you want to share a little bit more about what your podcast is about?
Sure. So I do a podcast called The Change Manifesto, and I have been exploring lately with women leaders how they have embraced change, especially not entirely because of the pandemic, but that certainly exacerbated, as I said a little bit earlier, you know, things that we probably knew were not working quite well, but, you know, a great economy and, you know, lots of forward momentum, you know, kind of covered it up well. A lot of that's been laid bare. And so I've done a series of interviews with women leaders, entrepreneurs, in season two, who really talk about how they were affected by the changes in their own business and their own practice and their own environment. And I think each one of them has got such a lot of insight on how individually we deal with the rolling of the dice and the, you know, no one told us to expect this, but we just have to navigate it anyway. So I think there's a lot of personal journey sharing that I think most people are finding very helpful. But generally in my podcast, I talk about the elements of how you understand change management and how you can incorporate them into projects and into your practice so that you can have an equal footing of the human factors of change as you're envisioning new projects or implementation of new technology. So that's my change manifesto.
Thank you. Thank you. So what is your outlook for healthcare from a change management expert? What is your outlook in the next 5 years?
Yeah, you know, I think that there's going to be a little bit of recognition, you know, not only that we went through something really difficult, but that there can't just be the, oh my gosh, thank goodness it's over, because we're not quite sure that it is, number one. And number two, you know, you don't want to waste all that knowledge that we gained, you know, so hard fought for over the last couple of years. So the organizations that I've been working with lately are very focused on, you know, how do we make sure that we're prepared for something like this? How do we take these lessons learned about how we had to pivot, what worked, what didn't, what kind of things got discarded, you know, that we don't want to ever have to make those challenging decisions again. We want to make sure that we keep, you know, the focus on, you know, including all of these attributes of the really fine care we want to deliver and not having, you know, to make, you know, terrible trade-offs. I think, you know, small things like the fact that telehealth became so, you know, kind of came out of the, you know, the shadows of where it had been operating for a while and became very foundational to getting some of the care needs addressed during the pandemic. I think that there's a lot to be learned there. You know, just even like remote monitoring, like, you know, EICUs, I think there's going to be an opportunity to learn how best to leverage those kind of capabilities going forward. And again, I think that the really innovative healthcare organizations are putting the monies that they do have closer to the bedside so that the folks who really know, here's what's not going to work going forward, here's what we've learned, let's make some changes. I think that I see as being, you know, one of the strategies to ensure that they're starting to future-proof.
Thank you for sharing that. Well, how can our listeners reach you?
Sure. The best way to reach me is to check out my website, which is angelchangemanagement.com. I have a Week to Change series of emails that you can subscribe to that gives you just sort of short, easy lessons in change management and an email form for a week. I do the podcast, of course, and then also a newsletter. So you can sign up for my newsletter at the website as well.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To view the complete show notes and all the links mentioned in today's episode, visit milesperillaconsulting.com /podcast. And before you go, make sure you follow or subscribe to this podcast so you can receive the latest episodes as soon as they're released. And if you're enjoying the show, please leave a rating and review in Apple Podcasts. Thank you again for joining me. This is your host, Miles Perilla, and you're listening to The Insightful Nurse Leader. I'll see you next time.